It's the same thing day after day. You settle in after a hard day's work to catch some Jerry Springer when, boom, gas comes pouring in, fumigation tents come down, and all of a sudden you want to just burst out and sing some Cher. In the cases like that, insurance is incredibly important, and that's why this week's sponsor on the Bloom Files are our friends over at Geico. Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. And I bet it can be hard work. You know what's easy? Bundling policies with Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle your homeowner's or renter's insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you already have so much to do around your home. Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. It's Geico easy. Visit geico.com today. That's geico.com. Truth is out there, and here, who knows? But either way, we are opening up the Bloom Files here on Post-Show Recaps, an X-Files First Watch / Rewatch podcast. Hi everybody, Mike Bloom here to unpack two very unique episodes of the X-Files. Two mouths here to talk about it, but only from one person. I mean, two people. Is that the big reveal that Angela and I were just two mouths talking out of one
disgusting.
Person?
Disgusting. I don't want to be that.
Would you rather be that, or would you rather be crossbred with some sort of farm animal?
The second, because I've just been watching Sweet Tooth on Netflix.
This is the normal. This is what I want to be now.
No, I don't want to be it, but I understand it.
You can sympathize. Well, these are two episodes that allows us to sympathize with a number of weirdos, in a manner of speaking. So we're talking season 5, episode 3, Unusual Suspects, and Season 5, Episode 5, and Angela Bloom's favorite episode of The X-Files, The Postmodern Prometheus.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, this is like the week that I've been most excited about. You know, the last couple of weeks I've been watching these episodes being like, dang, it's not this week
yet. If only it was this one.
Yeah, so I'm pretty pumped.
Yeah, I mean, these were two very fun episodes. I think I'm realizing that I would rather watch Freaky than Scary.
Well, yeah.
And not to say that those episodes that we watched in season 4 in particular weren't, like, very well done, but these were two episodes that I really enjoyed.
Yeah, they're interesting. There's a plot. There's, like, a mystery.
There's a plot with all of them.
No, but you know what I mean? There's, like, a mystery. There's something to be discovered, whereas I think the other ones are very much so, like, action-oriented. Yeah,
and I'll be honest, as much as I really liked the three-parter from last week, it's nice to always take some time away from, like,
yeah, nice little one and done.
Are aliens real? But are they not? Yeah. Is the government in on it? And are they not?
And I feel like sometimes you get very intense into the character arcs in those episodes, whereas this one was a nice, light character arc sort of filming.
Yeah, I mean, Mulder and Scully literally take a backseat in the first episode here.
Well,
but
yes.
The second one, like, it really isn't about them.
No. And the first one, Mulder's in it a bit, but he's really not in it at all.
Right.
And that's because they're filming the movie.
Yeah, so let's get into that. So the Unusual Suspects. So yeah, this was born out of the idea that David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson were still filming the movie.
Yes.
And so they're like, oh, we need something. Hey, let's do a Lone Gunman origin episode.
Yeah, and so this ended up being kind of a unique episode where it was very, like, Law and Order-y, and it actually
literally.
but yeah, I guess it served as, like, a little bit of a crossover episode, apparently, like, with the episode where Richard Belzer's Detective John Munch character is actually, like, that's his character in this, too.
Yeah, so that's, we got to talk about that. That sort of is the elephant in the room.
I guess they exist in the same universe.
Sort of, but this happens with multiple shows. Like, this is Richard Belzer's character. You would assume it's from Law & Order, but no, it's from Homicide, Life on the Street. But he has appeared in so many other shows.
This is his character. This is what he does.
Yeah, and so they just, I think a lot of, just like, the TV, I don't know, the TV inner cabal is just like, wouldn't it be funny if we bring this character onto,
yes,
like, every show? It's like that sort of theory that like the TGIF shared mm-hmm. universe, right? That like when you have Urkel appear on this other show, that means that it's in the same universe, and then it just sort of branches.
Yeah, but I think that the John Munch character is in every universe,
right? Exactly. Yeah. So it's more so like this John. Maybe he's like, you know, the Watcher from the Marvel universe, and that like
he's
on
everywhere.
Mission and can hop between the multiverse, or maybe it is all part of the same universe. But yeah, that was wild, especially because this was not a show on the same network.
Nope.
As Homicide Life.
But I guess
street.
That he was like very well recognized, so they just wanted to use him.
Yeah, Brendan Fitzpatrick told me actually that that Richard Belzer himself is actually like a pretty big conspiracy guy.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Like, I see that.
Like, apparently he penned a book about it. And
oh, really?
So I do wonder. I mean, we're going to get into celebrity
guest
appearances.
They're here.
Yeah, he's here. We're going to get into celebrity guest appearances in both of these episodes.
Yes.
But I do find it interesting that, like, I don't know if this was them approaching Richard Belzer or Richard Belzer's like, I got to be on this show. I've got things to say, man.
Maybe a little bit of both. But it's fun that he's playing a character that doesn't believe in it at all.
Exactly.
He thinks it's like a bunch of bullshit.
He's the best actor in the world.
Yeah.
So let's get into Unusual Suspects, because it takes place in 1989. Good year. The year of both of our births.
Yes, we were born in 1989.
Do we know what, or can we assume it's sort of like month this takes
no,
place in?
No, how would we know that?
I don't know. I mean, the clothes, when do these conventions usually take place for the FCC?
Maybe it did say it and we just missed it.
Yeah. Well, anyway, we're back in 1989. And we start in media res here, right? We're
mm-hmm.
like, you see a SWAT team breaking into an industrial park. There's, for a moment, an obscured naked guy under
a
box.
Yeah, you didn't realize this was Mulder at first, but I knew, I mean, not only did I know because I've seen the episode, but like, his voice is so recognizable. I can't believe you didn't realize it was him.
I guess I just don't, I'm not used to David Duchovny yelling so much that like, it seems foreign to me.
You'll get used to it.
I'm used to, you know, David Duchovny is really low talking, monotone speaking, that like, when he raises his voice above a certain decibel, it's not recognizable.
Especially him yelling, they're here.
Yeah.
They're here!
They're here! They're here! Meanwhile, the lone gunmen are, you know, found not too far away, and they're going to get detained here. And this is also when we find out that obviously these guys either, like, barely know each other, you know, because Langley's calling Frohickey Doohickey at this point.
Yeah, and so they're captured by the police, basically.
Yeah, they basically get arrested, right?
Yeah.
They're like, what
at
are
this
you
point,
doing
we don't,
here?
We'll find out at the end of the episode what actually happens, but yeah.
Yeah, because there's also, like, they find some blood on the ground, so they're like, you guys are in a lot of trouble. Tell us what happened here.
Yeah, they're also like, you broke into a warehouse, but nothing's been stolen. What's the deal? Like,
yeah,
what are you doing here?
It also should be noted that the one guy they pull aside here is Byers, who now I finally recognize, right? Byers is the one in the suit.
And he's
we'll
a buyer.
Out, and we'll find out this episode is like, probably I would say the most naive out of all of them, or at
and
least
the most
in 1989 he was.
Well, so in 1989, he really was not a conspiracy theorist, whereas Byers and Langley are very much so in the space of like a hacker sort of like going against the norm. But yeah, John Fitzgerald's Byers.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's, he wasn't always, you know, he was always in the proximity of the conspiracy of it all, because
I guess so. He works for the government.
He was born on 11/22/63 and he was named after the JFK assassination, right? Like, the apple's not going to fall too far from the tree.
I guess so, but he seems like a very conservative type of, like, normal dude. Works for the FCC, like, can you get more boring?
Well, what I do find interesting, and Spencer makes note of this as well, is that it's billed to be, right, a lone gunman flashback episode. It's really focused on Byers.
Yes, and it's Byers.
And it really seems like Frohickey and Langley were just like, it's not like they're just there, but we find out much less about them, I think, and much more about Byers.
Yeah, and Byers is narrating the whole thing. So the whole episode is like taking place in flashback because Byers is telling the detective what happened.
And, which I find a unique choice because, I mean, I don't know if this is commonly held belief, but I think if I'm power ranking the three lone gunmen, I think Byers is at the bottom for me, just because, like you said, he did seem a little more milquetoast. So I find it an interesting choice to be like, I know you're interested in these other two guys, but we're really going to focus
on
the one guy.
You have to remember, if Byers is talking, you're probably believing him, whereas if Langley and Frohickey are talking, you're like, I don't know if that's actually what happened. You know, in the episode where Frohickey is even in basically doing a media res about the cigarette smoking man.
That's true. Yeah.
Then, you know, we still weren't sure if that was true. Whereas Byers is the the narrator, then I don't know, I believe him.
Yeah, so, I mean, it turns out that Byers, like you said, working for the FCC, seems like they're at, like, some sort of...
They are at a computer and electronics convention.
I was about to say, it's probably an electronics convention, right? This was,
this was big.
Before, you know, gamers took over the concept of E3. This is basically the pre-E3.
Yes, exactly.
And so Byers is sort of being a shill for the FCC, while Frohickey and Langley are competitors in the bootleg cable industry.
Yep, basically selling stolen cable television converters.
Yeah, you remember this back in the day,
right? I do, oh yes.
I mean, I know, again, we were born in this year, but I feel like even when we were young,
yeah, in the 90s.
Concept of stealing cable still was a thing.
Yeah, where you could, like, put in something or use an antenna or...
Yeah, or, like, yeah. What they were selling was essentially, like, this little,
like... converter.
Yeah, this, like, little, like, metal box that you hook into, and essentially it would, like, steal radio waves or whatever.
Yeah, I don't know how it works, but I guess they were trying to make money off of this idea.
Yeah, and so what's going to bring Byers in, a la a film noir, right? It's always about a pair of legs and a pair of sunglasses.
What drives me a little crazy about this episode is, well, the woman who plays whatever her...
Not Suzanne Modesky.
No, her name is Suzanne Modesky.
Oh,
her
right.
name is not Holly. Well, the woman who plays her is quite beautiful and very pretty. I don't find her to be like Jessica Rabbit, like...
Drop dead
gorgeous to the point where somebody sees her walking across the room and their eyes just like catch her. You know, it's like, I don't find her to be that kind of pretty, but I guess maybe it's a 90s pretty.
Yeah, 90s pretty. I'm not sure because, yeah, I'm inclined to agree. Maybe it's also the way that she was coming across.
Like, she comes across a little dead in the eyes.
Exactly. Like, I think she's trying to bring in that sort of mystique element,
yeah, and
but
it
wasn't
it.
Exactly catching to me. I mean, I guess... it works for Byers, evidently.
Yeah, I guess he's into that, like, I don't know, very, like, plain Jane, blonde lady vibe.
Yeah, but, I mean, she hooks him line and sinker when she basically, like, sells him the story, right, of, oh, I think I have my three-year-old child's been kidnapped by my dark
Yeah, she shows him
ex.
This picture and says that her daughter's been kidnapped by her ex-boyfriend, and she's trying to find her daughter, but she's running from the ex-boyfriend.
Right.
And then she also says that she has this piece of paper.
That says ARPANET.
Yeah, white corp.
ARPANET. So I guess I'm assuming that's a real thing, but it sounds so freaking doofy.
It does sound doofy.
I guess because the internet was such a new
so
concept.
So it stands for the Advanced Research Projects Agency Network.
Oh, okay. That
yeah.
makes, I like it better as an acronym than just calling it the
yeah.
ARPANET.
Which is part of the United States Department of Defense.
Yeah. Yeah, basically it's like an internal network for the Department of Defense.
It was the first wide area packet switch network with distributed control. And one of the first networks to implement IP protocol suite.
Ooh, thank you, Angelopedia.
Well, thank you, Wikipedia.
For that deep dive on ARPANET.
ARPANET, anyway.
ARPANET, I don't know, it sounds like some sort of bug killer, maybe?
Yeah, well, yeah.
Yeah, maybe I'm thinking of like, or like Alpo, right? Like ARPANET, maybe. Would be the dog internet.
Anyway, Byers realizes that's what it stands for, the Defense Department's computer network.
But basically...
She's like, hack into this for me, please.
Well, listen, I think he was thinking with maybe a different type of head that has him do something incredibly illegal and hack into the government internet base.
Yeah, and he's like a pretty loyal government employee at this time, so it's kind of weird that he's like, sure.
Yeah, though I think maybe what they were hinting at when they introduced him was like, he seemed fairly frustrated with his career. I mean,
I think he was bored. Like,
yeah, I mean,
this
he's
dumb.
He's not as checked out as his coworker playing Dig Dug on the computer, but he's like,
yeah.
I think he would definitely, I would imagine he's sort of having that crisis, right, of like, what am I doing?
Right.
He's not fully in on conspiracy theories yet, as you're saying, but he's definitely
But he's
like,
a company man. He's not questioning, like, the government at this point. He's just questioning what he's doing with his life.
Yeah, so they hack into the ARPANET. And they find an encrypted file under the name Suzanne Modesky.
Which Holly, quote-unquote, claims is her daughter's name.
Exactly. She's like, oh, why is this file here? Basically, what she wanted him to do was for him to hack in and get this file. But then Holly immediately says, like, we've got to hide. It's
well,
nice
no, stuff. No, no. But first, she has him printed out on classic 90s printer
like
paper.
The dot matrix paper. The little perforated holes that you tear off on the
Loved
side and
stuff.
Feel so satisfying.
But yeah, so basically she's like, oh no, quick. And they duck down and she's like, that's my boyfriend. And passing by Byers' booth is Mulder.
I do love watching babyface Fox Mulder here. I guess it also helps that David Duchovny, like his, it didn't seem like he's aged much in the past five years.
No, he hasn't.
So like, he could pass reliably for 1989 Fox Mulder.
Yeah, and he puts on, I mentioned this, but he's very good at acting like pre-X-Files Fox Mulder.
Yeah, at this point, like, you know, when they're going to look up his file later, right? Like, he's like still in good with the FBI. He's still like number one psycho killer chaser.
Yeah, he's on the special victim or special crimes unit. Right?
Yeah, exactly. So this is before, you know, the whole hypnotism, accesses the repressed memories. I mean, we're going to find that the lone gunmen are going to become Mulder's enablers, basically.
Yeah, basically. But I think that this is, it's very fun when he's like, what? Conspiracy theories.
So this is where, so we know now that Byers knows at least of Frohicke. And I think Frohicke and Langley know at least a little bit of Byers, right? Like, they keep calling him the narc.
Yeah.
So I think it's clear that
they probably do this, like, a sort of, like, circuit of conventions together.
Right. And so, like, Frohicke and Langley think of him as, like, the suit and tie, right? And Byers is like, well, I know this kind of sketchy guy who knows his way around, you know, the dark internet, dark web, as it were.
And can translate this file for us, basically.
As Frohicke himself will say, use his kung fu.
Mm-hmm. So they try to recruit Frohicke to help him cipher file, but basically Frohicke's like, I could do this for you, but it will take years. So, or like a really long time. Yeah, so why don't we just go attack this guy?
Yeah, like just go talk to him directly. And Holly's like, no. Yeah. Meanwhile,
should have been suspicious.
There's a fun moment of Mulder sort of mulling around the alien visitors exhibit.
Yeah,
right?
Which is funny.
But basically Frohicke and Byers chase down Mulder. And Mulder's like, oh, hey, I'm looking for this lady. Also, I'm with the FBI. And of course, they're still buying in at the moment. They're like, oh my God, he's with the FBI.
Yeah, like this goes deep. But basically, and then the poor guy that Byers was at the convention.
Yeah, the poor Dick Jug guy takes the fall.
Yeah, because they find out, like, I guess that was fast tracking of that hack. But yeah. I guess the Defense Department probably has pretty good screens on
there. I would imagine so. And I'm assuming not that many people are accessing the ARPANET outside of government facilities. So
that's
like,
true.
Maybe it's a pretty fast ping. But
also,
yeah.
Why did he have a computer at a convention? That's odd.
I'm not sure. I don't know why.
Is it to get work done?
Yeah, I don't know.
Working remotely?
Could it be like if, well, what are they trying to do
I think
as
it's
the
just,
FCC?
They're public advocates. So they're just there to say like, believe in the FCC.
Right, so it's not even like signing them up for a mailing list
or
anything.
No, I mean, maybe they have a signed sheet where you can get a newsletter, but I don't think that's
thing. I think the only thing would be like, oh yeah, we're going to enter names into the computer, but
maybe.
Otherwise, I agree. Maybe it's just because they've gone to so many, the Dig Dug guy was like, I'd like a computer.
I'm
and they're
bored
like, oh, okay,
fun.
You clearly need it for something. Yeah, and he's using it to play video games, basically.
Yeah.
Wonder what happened to that guy. He was probably murdered.
Maybe. No, he's probably just like put on trial or something and, you know, like
murdered. Exactly. He ends up going to jail, unlike the lone gunman here. Really fun reveal, especially for the D&D inclined such as myself, where we get, you know, Langley and all of his fellow nerds.
It looked like they're playing poker.
You pointed this out when we watched it. Like, I love the fact that Langley's crew all sort of look like him, right? They have
they're all
glasses,
like very classic 90s
long
nerd
hair. They have like
freaks and geeks
stogies sticking out of their mouth. And yeah, like you said, it pans around the table to be like, oh, this is a high stakes poker game. But it looks like they're not like, I don't know, I couldn't tell if they were playing some sort of game or if they were just making bets on Langley rolling a d20 and getting an outcome.
Yeah, maybe it's a little bit of both. Like, they're in the middle of a campaign and they decide to do this like break where they
like
do
side
bets.
Yeah, like, oh, I bet you won't crit, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So
because otherwise it would almost be like D&D meets craps of, oh, I bet you won't roll this number.
They probably are. It's probably a little bit of both. So
I do like Langley's character name, Lord Manhammer.
Yeah, that's why I think they are playing a campaign.
If I ever get another character in the post-show recap Discord D&D, I think I'm going to call him Lord Manhammer.
Lord Mike Hammer.
Lord Mike Hammer. Or Lord Manham Mike.
Both are good.
Both. Lord Manham Mike, Mike Hammer.
Yeah, perfect.
It's a really big mouthful.
Anyway, they're going to see Langley because they're like, we need Langley to help hack into the database for the FBI now.
Yeah, because his kung fu is the best.
Well, because Frohicke's like, what's going on with when they go to Mulder, they find out Mulder's in the FBI, and they're like, hmm, that's weird. So they're going to go find Langley to help him find more about Holly, because Rohicky has made Byers realize this is like a little...
Like, you've been set up, Pally.
Or just like, we need to investigate more, you know, like, you can't just go off a pretty face.
Yeah, exactly. But I do like the use of the word Kung Fu, right? This is still...
Very much so in the Hacker.
Yeah, when did Hackers come out?
I don't know, but this is all very Hackers. Like,
yeah, I mean, they're not dressed up like, you know, Matthew Lillard and,
no.
And Angelina Jolie. But
no,
like,
but that's like the vibe is like the underbelly of the internet. You know, people
Yeah, Hackers
who,
was 1995, so it was only like a few years before this happened.
Yeah, so very much so like that.
Yeah, so they're going to go into this motel room. They're going to find out that, dun-dun-dun, there is no Suzanne Modesky that's actually...
No, there is no Holly. There is a Suzanne Modesky, but it's the same person. It's
right,
not her
exactly.
daughter.
But this Suzanne Modesky is considered basically like armed and dangerous.
Yeah, she's wanted for murder, terrorism, and sabotage of a weapons facility.
Yeah, because she was previously an employee at this weapons lab, and it yes. said that she... blew up the lab and killed everybody. Mm-hmm. She's considered unstable and psychotic.
Yeah, but she finds them doing this.
Yeah, so let's talk about this, because I was, when we were watching, I was a little confused about how she found them, but you assume that they invited her?
Yeah, I'm assuming that Byers said, oh, we're going to this hotel room, meet us there, because, like, prior to going and with Langley, that basically, like, they're going to find Langley to do some investigating on her, but, like, Byers is under the impression that they're not going to find anything. You know, he's mm-hmm. like, he's like, oh no, I trust Holly. So he's like, probably told Holly, I'm going to go get this guy, meet us at this hotel room. You know, like.
It also should be pointed out, apparently, I found out that when they were filming this scene where Suzanne comes in, like mm-hmm. she comes to the hotel room, they, you know, they find out that she has a gun. It's yeah. really now this dangerous cliffhanger of, oh my god, they ran into an unstable individual.
Yeah.
Apparently they were really trying to embody one of your favorite films, The Wizard of Oz.
Ugh, barf.
You don't like The Wizard of
Oz? I don't. It makes me really uncomfortable.
Is there anything in particular that makes you uncomfortable?
The whole vibe.
The whole vibe?
The whole vibe. It's just the way that Judy Garland talks, the munchkins, the weird, like, flying. I don't like it.
Is it because they put a dog in trouble almost immediately?
Maybe. That's a dog that looks much like my dog.
Yeah, you're like off the trail.
No, I just don't like the whole vibe. It makes me really like feel icky.
Yeah,
I hope there's someone else out there that feels that way, and I hope I'm not truly offending people.
No, there are some people I know who are not fans of Wizard of Oz. I don't know if it's necessarily for the reasons that you ascribe.
I get a very weird gut feeling about The Wizard of Oz, and it's not good.
It's interesting. That's very interesting. I don't know why. We're in color now. We're going to go into black and white next episode.
That's
so maybe,
true.
Maybe it's not that. But yeah,
I don't think it's that.
Apparently, they were inspired by like the image of, oh, here's the Scarecrow and the Tin Man and the Cowardly Lion cowering in the corner.
I see.
And so that's what they sort of get here. But this is when Suzanne gives her side of the story, right? She's like,
yes.
You've got to believe me. Yes, I lied. I used the generic wallet photo for my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
But basically,
the government is trying to hunt me down because I have information that they are trying to test mm-hmm. a aerosolized gas that causes paranoia and anxiety on the public in Baltimore.
You know what I'm thinking is, Angela, you and I were born in 1989. You and I think, are very upfront about our issues with anxiety. Could it be that we have been exposed to this gas in this very
pivotal
year?
Potentially, I do have asthma as well.
Yeah, so listen, don't go for those inhalers too quickly.
Yeah,
but,
no.
But yeah, so she basically feels like, oh yeah, you know, they're trying to bury me because I know all this information. That's why I needed the file.
Yeah, and so basically she goes to the weapons facility in New Mexico because she thinks that that's where they have the gas. And that's where all of this happens, is because she is like, trying to, like, I don't know, blow it up, and then, like, blow it up in the matter of breaking the news, not like bombs, but...
what I love is...
Blow up their spot, I should say.
Well, what I love is, up to this point, even though Frohicke and Langley are more of the freakier guys compared to Byers, nobody...
Believes her.
They're not really conspiracy guys. It's her who really is the match to start the fuse, right? She's talking about, like, the government's in on everything.
They
put Bibles in the hotels.
Yeah, they're more the guys that are just, like, about the internet. Like, the dark web and, like, really, like, hacking into stuff. And they're not really, like, thinking... And they probably think the government isn't doing great things, but the conspiracy stuff isn't there yet. And they also, the thing that they do, I always thought this was really funny about Suzanne Modesky, how she's like, it's aerosolized gas that causes paranoia and anxiety. But it's like, that's exactly what you're saying.
Exactly. Like maybe they tested it on her.
Yeah. Like maybe you, yeah, exactly.
I mean, to be fair though. So yes, you think she's going down this weird trail of like, really? Hotel Bibles are meant to electronically spy on everyone. But then as they read through her file, they say that basically, like, the government set up a bug in her dentist's office. She immediately runs off to the bathroom to pull out her tooth.
Yeah, this was a wild assumption.
To reveal some sort of, like, cathode in it.
Yeah, so basically it's a tracking device in a tooth that she has, which is, like, a very wild assumption that you should, like, a weird line to draw between they put a bug in my dentist's office to, oh, it's in my tooth.
How do you think they did that? Because I'm imagining
a cavity.
So you think it's like...
Or like a root canal.
Well, like I was going to say, it was like pretty darn deep in there.
Yeah, maybe she had a root canal and they, you know, a dentist could tell you you need a root canal and you believe them, right?
I would imagine so. You don't trust dentists. I guess that's the lesson.
I guess that's the lesson,
because they're putting tracking devices in your body.
Yeah.
So they find out that this gas is being stored in this nearby warehouse, which, surprise, surprise, is the warehouse where we open this episode. And so this is where... They not only come into contact with Mulder, right? Like Mulder finds them, holds them at gunpoint, but here come two other goons, separate from Mulder, to try to take Suzanne. But then,
they start firing at Mulder, and they hit the
gas.
Yeah, they hit basically the asthma inhaler boxes, and the gas is exposed. Mulder's exposed to the gas,
which is why he starts like tearing off his clothes. Yeah. This is where like the anxiety comes.
Yeah,
from.
And he's having like a fit, basically hallucinating, seeing aliens in the warehouse.
Yeah, which again might have been like the very first step here, even besides the hypnosis stuff.
Yeah.
But Suzanne is going to kill the goons while they're distracted with Mulder.
But meanwhile, more men arrive.
Yeah, so then while this like humble bassoon plays, because Suzanne is able to get away, leaving the lone gunman just being like, here come, you know, door opens, light floods in, here comes X, 1989
X. 1989 X, who looks exactly the same.
I'm surprised at this. I thought, I don't know, I thought maybe it would have been Deep Throat.
So Deep Throat and X are both existing at this time.
Mm-hmm.
Deep Throat's the one that is going to be the sort of playing both sides. At this point, X is not playing both sides.
Yeah, X is prominently in the pocket
of whoever.
Whoever's representing this gas-toting company.
Yeah, well, he's in the cover-up conspiracy.
Yeah, he's the cleanup
syndicate,
crew.
Whatever. And I mean, so he basically is somebody who is probably working for the cigarette-smoking man at this point. Because remember, he does everything. He covers up JFK. He does everything.
Yeah, and so that's what they're doing right now. Like, speaking of cleaning up, they're bagging up the goons. Even though doesn't one of them say, like, I'm alive? And they still, like, kill him, basically. They take off them the slate of medicine.
Well, there's a reason they don't kill Mulder. And that's because X recognizes him as somebody important.
Mm-hmm.
So he knows who Mulder is already, probably because he works for the cigarette smoking man.
So Byers got a lot of cojones right now, basically confronting X and these people being like, what do you think you're doing? You're behind this all. You can't get away with it. And gets a big old gun pointed at him and the other lone gunman.
Yeah, exactly. And so he, this is how, I guess at this point, X is just going to let them go.
He's going to let them go, but he's going to leave a certain impression, right? He's going to, he's basically...
Right, so Byers is like, you covered up the JFK assassination as well. And X is like, I heard it was a lone gunman.
And they're like, oh, that's a great name.
That's a great, great name. And then he leaves.
Oh, that's... I really like that one.
But the police then arrive.
Then the police arrive, and this is where we get our first scene, right?
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Richard Belzer not having any of this.
Yeah, he's like, that's...
Do I look like Geraldo to you?
Yes.
Do I have a mustache?
Yeah, so basically he thinks this guy's crazy. He's full of nonsense conspiracy theories.
But
they don't have anything to hold him on, so...
Well, it's because Mulder bails him out. Like, Mulder comes forward. Once he comes to, he comes forward with the story basically saying, like... These guys have nothing to do with it.
He's like, yes, all this happened. Like, all these people were there, but these guys are innocent. So let them go.
So the matter of Suzanne Modesky, though, is still on the table.
Yes.
And the lone gunmen are able to realize that she's playing to go to the papers, to the papes. to reveal everything.
Right.
Unfortunately for her, they don't believe her.
Which is fair, because it's all crazy sounding.
Yeah, I mean, even, you know, especially even back then.
You can't just go to a newspaper and say, I got this amazing story.
Not that newspaper. I think you could go to some of these other publications, right, and be like,
verify facts.
Yeah. So they're going to meet her on the street, not homicide life on the street. And basically, you know, she kisses Byers.
Yeah, which is weird.
Saying, oh, thank you for everything you've done. And warns them, no matter how paranoid you are, you're not paranoid enough.
Mm-hmm.
As she tries to run away and gets captured by X and his crew.
Yeah, totally.
So RIP Suzanne Modesky, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm. Or at least she's like in jail or something.
I don't know. I think, again, they're the cleanup crew. They just probably asphyxiated a guy who was alive in a body bag. I got to imagine they killed her at this point.
I shan't say anything.
Oh, interesting. Well, we end the episode, I think, on a very fun note. It seems like, are they back at the convention center?
Yeah, so they have to, basically they left during the middle of the convention. They have to go clean up their booths.
Yeah, that's true, you know, as they're sort of ruminating over everything. But Mulder's going to show up. He's gonna tip him off of, oh yeah, Suzanne Modesky's no longer wanted, but still missing. It's clear that he is now starting to come a bit
wise. Confused. He basically was told to find this lady because she was a murderer, and then told not to because she, it's been dropped, and he didn't really give a reason why.
Yeah, and so maybe the gas is still lingering in his system a bit, but there's a really fun final shot here, right, where the lone gunman basically, like, sit down with him and start going into all of their newfound conspiracy theories as well, and, like, a partnership is born right now.
Yeah, and there's a part where they're like, and it's all done by, like, I don't know, UFOs and extra, he's like, what?
I love that. Yeah, I think, like you said, David Duchovny does a very fun job as surprised babyface Mulder.
Yeah.
And it's also fun to think about that, the, you know, we don't know. Again, I didn't watch the first Lone Gunman episode, but I know that these guys sort of came out of nowhere. And so it's cool to find out that Mulder sort of has always had a connection with them as long as he has been interested in the paranormal.
Yeah, and that's kind of like in retrospect, because up until this point, they were using them as basically information, like exposition touters.
Exactly. So it's fun to find out that they are more so like, you know, they are connected over sort of being part of the same belief system.
Yeah.
Than just, oh yeah, these are guys that I can go to if I want to do anything.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
So it's a really fun episode. I imagine this is not the only lone gunman focused episode.
No, but I think the rest of them are not as like missing Mulder and Scully.
Okay.
Because like the reason Mulder and Scully aren't in this is because of the movie, but like, they're in every episode.
Do you know if this was sort of the, again, like the starting point of, oh, we could do a series after these guys?
I think so. I think they realized they had something. I don't think they've made the decision yet, but, you know, at least introduce them in a more succinct way.
All right. Well, we were not so succinct about that episode, but it was still really fun. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, folks, it is finally time.
Finally.
To open up the comic book that is Postmodern Prometheus. We're back!
Is that your Cher impression?
How did you know?
I just knew. I think you mentioned Cher last week on the episode.
Did I? On
the podcast. I don't remember, but I got super pumped because I was like, wait till you see.
Yeah, so let's talk about this. You mentioned this last week. So this is an episode that I have watched before, but to your point, I really did not have much interest in it.
And you didn't have any context, I think.
Yeah, from what I recall, it was something where, you know, I remember,
I think you had to watch,
because I watched Leonard Butts. I watched the post-Super Bowl episode because I did a podcast with Jordan.
And then
Farhart.
I just think I made you watch this.
Yeah, you're
me?
Like, oh, if you want to watch another X-Files episode. And I said, okay. And I was certainly interested by it, but I will fully admit, like, I didn't remember any of it. There were certain parts that were coming back to me when we were watching here.
It's really, to your credit, I mean, it's hard to get into this episode because it is super standalone.
Yeah.
And if you don't have the context of Mulder and Scully, there's a lot of, like, in-jokes about how they react to things, and I think you need to be on board with them as a pair, as a unit of investigators, to really, like, care what's happening here. But I mean, this is my favorite episode. It's so good.
It's such an interesting
story. From start to finish, it's amazing.
Yeah. So this is the X-Files take on Frankenstein.
Yeah, to an extent, yes.
To an extent, because I think the modern Prometheus, I do believe, is a name of a Mary Shelley book.
Yeah, so I think that it's, you know, it's definitely meant to have that. They also wrote the script with Cher in mind, and they couldn't get her.
Well, because I read that Chris Carter, like, went on a Cher binge for a while over the summer and was like, oh, it'd be fun to incorporate this in here.
Yeah, and they also wanted Roseanne Barr to play the...
Oh, woof.
Yeah, but...
Bullet dodged.
Yeah, for sure. And the lady who plays the mom is so amazing. She's, like, so great. So
let's get into it, because even this framing device... Super strange, because we are in a comic book called The Great Mutato.
Yeah, which, I mean, I think it's just more about how they introduce, you know, like how they do Once Upon a Time and they have, like, the storybook. I don't think you're meant to think in a comic book.
Well, it's interesting. Well, I think we'll get into that with the ending, right? Because isn't the interpretation of the ending that, oh, no, that wasn't the real ending. This is part of the comic book.
No, I mean, I never felt that. I always felt like this was the real ending, but, like, it was, like, a in a comic book way that it just all worked out that way, you know?
So I will say, and Spencer,
I always thought it was like a cinematic thing.
Yeah. I do find it interesting. Maybe in like, if this episode was not, it was 10 years later, they would have adopted more comic booky types of things.
Yeah, maybe.
If it was indeed like using like the panels or, because really we sort of have it at the beginning and end, but I think
it's a very fantasy-esque episode though, because it's all in black and white, so I think you're just supposed to meant that it's all in that style and it's very fantastical, and even the music that's not Cher is like a weird sort of quirky music.
It really is.
The tenting is like very like what's that movie, Big Fish,
I totally like almost larger than life.
It's very fantastical regard.
So here we are, Izzy and Booger. What a nickname. Poor Booger.
I love Booger. Booger's great. And in the end of the episode, when you find out they all have sort of like animal experimentations that were done on them, I guess, to try to get another mutado, I like that he's the horse.
Yeah, well, because he has the ponytail, right?
Yeah.
I read that particularly Izzy and his friends are not actors. They just found rando guys that they're like, oh, this would be fun to bring on.
Yeah, so basically, I agree.
Yeah, which is an interesting, you know, it's not unfounded. Going back to another David Simon project, like that was very much out of the wire of just finding people who were less so actors and more so people who fit the part. And I think it works here where, like, you know, Izzy does not necessarily have to go through any major acting beats. You're not going to the Stanislavski school to grab someone if you're just like, yeah, you kind of look like someone that would play, you know, a simple-minded hick.
Yeah, a simple-minded hick who kind of looks like a bird.
I forget, so do they say where this takes place?
I don't remember.
Because, yeah, there's an interesting sort of, like, suburbia quality to it, but also Izzy's mom, Shayna, it, like, talks with a southern accent.
I think it's supposed to be in the Midwest.
So it sort of is like that crossbreeding, for lack of a better term.
Right, and, which is not a great stereotype, but still, Shayna.
I mean,
oh, it's in Indiana.
Indiana. I feel like that makes sense in terms of, again, like a cross center of rural, but not too rural.
Yeah.
But also not too urban. Like they're going to a comic book convention.
Yeah. So they're probably driving to like a more metropolitan area of Indiana. Yeah.
I mean, if we're talking about celebrity culture in this episode, we got to talk about Jerry Springer.
Yeah. Real Jerry Springer, too.
Real Jerry Springer. And this also, I think, is a big sign of the times where I think some people.
This was big.
Some people might say, like, oh, the town reaction was too OTT, but like, no, I mean, you and I were of a sound mind, even at that point, to know about, like, the culture surrounding Maury and Jerry Springer.
Yeah, and also just, like, the mob mentality. I mean, this is pre-social media, so this is what social media does today.
Yeah.
You know, by sort of putting things on TV and big claims and, you know, making things, like, very dramatic, like, you're the father, you're not the father.
Yeah, it's
like
watching the circus on television.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Like, oh, these are big sideshow acts, especially with this version of Jerry Springer, which is like, there's the wolf baby and everything like that. So it's almost like watching the Weekly World News come to life.
Yeah.
But at the same time, people almost idolize Jerry Springer because he brings so much weird entertainment.
And he's on their TV. You know, it's like anybody on TV at this point in time was considered somebody to
admire. Exactly.
Like,
it's one of those things where even, you know, and we grew up with this as well, even though we were not from Indiana, where if you were being interviewed by the news
for
whatever
huge.
Reason, like the next day people were like, oh, I saw you on the news.
Well, this is where, this is very important for you, but I think this is the idea where reality television comes from, is that anybody can be on TV.
Exactly.
And then we move into that in the early 2000s, but at this moment in time, not everybody can be on TV. So if you're on TV, it's very cool.
It means like you're someone special.
Yes. So,
and so when you're also given the opportunity to possibly be on TV,
you
that
jump.
Means you're special. And so you're like, oh, this is great.
So, yeah, basically this woman, Shayna, sees the episode of Jerry Springer with the wolf baby and hears about Mulder. And that's why she sends a letter to Mulder.
Yeah, but before that happens, we see a fumigation tent comes down. We see what looks like to be some sort of like urinal cake. Get put on the stove, and then a Cher song starts to play.
Yes, which is, honestly, from that second, you're just in.
Yeah, because I was like, oh, this is weird.
But you were getting jazzed by the song.
I mean, I love Cher, and I think they chose some very good songs.
They did, yeah.
We should mention, so Cher originally didn't sign on to the episode because she was like,
I don't know about this.
Well, it's also because she was just, it was just, okay, you're going to sing at the very end.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, I wouldn't do this. But then I think she has said in retrospect, like, once I watched the episode and realized what it was, I realized I should have done it.
Yeah, because I mean, they basically, not only is this about Frankenstein, but the Great Mutado is basically like similar to the character from
Mask. Rocky.
Yeah.
Who Cher plays Rocky's mom.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the Great Mutado sort of like has an obsession with Cher.
Yes, because of that.
And because he sort of like represents this like caring parental figure that he never really had.
Yeah, beautiful artist, a woman who like cares about people, you know, all of that.
So it should be noted that even though Cher doesn't appear, she did license three of her songs.
She did. And the person at the end of the episode is in a Cher impersonator.
Yeah, or just like a stand-in, because they don't
know. It's a Cher impersonator.
Really?
They hire a Cher impersonator.
Chad Michaels?
Maybe. Because she's doing all the, like, she's doing the movements.
I guess that's true. Yeah, those typical Cherisms.
Not just a woman in a wig.
Shayna's really, I guess, drawn into Jerry Springer, because she does not notice the gas whatsoever.
Yeah, this is wild. That she's just, like, she's standing
like,
there.
Imagine if her house is on fire. She's not paying attention to that?
Yeah, she just starts coughing when smoke gets into the room.
She's like, oh, popcorn went down the wrong tube.
And we find out later that what is happening is that the Great Mutado, you think at first that he's the one doing this, but it's his dad.
Right, that it's like, oh, essentially this is like a serial rapist.
I don't think he's having sex with these women. I think he's artificially inseminating them.
Right, but I think the implication early on, right,
is that he's like, this guy is like a rapist, like a weirdo that goes into people's houses. Yeah,
because all this, because after the credits, which I should mention, I don't know, I kind of wish the credits were in black and white.
I feel like they never do that, though. They never have credits like that.
I know, but if
like,
you do things like you change the truth is out there message,
I know.
Like,
they never change the credits. They don't even change the credits until...
That's true. Poor Mitch Pileggi.
Yeah, he's never added, and then in the 8th season, I want to say, they add a totally new credits because it's the one without Mulder, so...
Yeah. Well, only when they were forced to.
Yeah, only when they were forced to. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, I want the old ones back.
But the reason why all this comes up a bit sketchy is because we see Mulder and Scully driving to town. Scully reads this letter that was sent from Shayna. That was basically...
Shayna Berkowitz.
That was basically like, even though, again, she has like a southern accent for someone named Shayna Berkowitz, who basically said like, something weird happened. I got conked out watching Jerry Springer, woke up 3 days later, now I'm pregnant. With my son.
Yeah, so she says that this happened mysteriously impregnated while unconscious by an unknown presence 18 years ago.
Like, essentially like an immaculate conception.
Yeah, so, and then all of a sudden she has her son Izzy, and then she said it just happened again.
Yep, exactly.
She heard about him from Jerry Springer, so if you could please come and investigate.
Yeah, which I do love that idea as well, that like, Mulder, I mean, Mulder's going to joke, should I get my own Y-900 number? Yeah, I would say, like, considering if he's getting TV exposure, it actually wouldn't be too bad of an idea.
Yeah, and then so now they're on their way to rural Indiana.
Yeah, so Shayna is, I'm so glad it's not played by Roseanne Barr for many reasons.
Yes,
but the character is... I'd say the character is pretty simple, and I think a good first hint as to this town, because I think this is different than something like War of the Coprophages, which also showed this idea of mob mentality, but not as, like, for lack of a better term, animalistic here.
Like, well, I mean, they're playing off the Frankenstein idea of everything.
Right,
but
it's a little more OTT.
But yeah, they're all followers, they're all sheep, you know, everybody is just...
Some of them quite literally.
Quite literally. But yeah, basically... I love the scene where she sits them down and she pours them like store brand soda.
Yeah, but like a full glass of it too.
From a 2 liter bottle. That's so like early 90s to me.
Yeah,
like,
I do appreciate that they say, you know, oh, it took me a couple months to find out I was pregnant. Because that was my thing of like, how do you immediately know
you don't.
That you're pregnant?
Well, from experience, you typically don't.
Exactly. So I'm glad they sort of went through that. But the weirdness comes from the fact, you know, Scully is really going to be her Scully-est.
Yeah, she's like, this is dumb.
This is dumb. Obviously, like, you had sex without remembering it, but Shayna...
Or you were raped.
Yeah, but Shayna brings up the fact that after she had Izzy, she had her tubes tied.
Yeah, so she's like, explain that, and Scully will,
and
like...
And also, explain the empty jar of peanut butter.
Yeah, and then she basically walks around her house saying, and he ate all my peanut butter.
Yeah, though I wonder, now that we know, was it just like the old man was hungry? Or?
No. Basically, the old man goes into the house to do these experiments, but brings the great Mutado with him so that he can experience life.
So it essentially is also like a bring your child to work day.
Yeah, and so basically he's running around these people's homes, eating their peanut butter, dancing and hanging out while his dad is doing weird shit to the moms.
Yeah, so he just really has an affinity for peanut butter specifically. Because exactly. They don't point out like, you ate my rump roast. It's like, nope.
No, he just likes peanut butter.
Which... Everyone has their vices.
Yeah, he's like a kid almost. He has a kid-like mentality.
I wonder if the old farmer doesn't let them eat peanut butter at home. And
no,
that's
he does.
Like.
He gives them a peanut butter sandwich. It's just his favorite food. Get over it.
I'm trying to. It's an interesting choice.
Well, fun fact. Let's move into Scully discovering the comic book. So, did you know that the Great Mutado is a comic book character created by... Matt, what's-his-face, who created The Simpsons.
Yes, Matt Groening.
Yeah, I never know how to say his name.
Oh, Matt what's-his-face.
I never know how to say his last name.
Yeah, because so, from what I read, so it seemed like there was an issue of, like, Simpsons comics, which had the Great Mutado, like, as a character.
Yeah, and so they wanted to use that, and he was like, fine, I don't care.
Yeah, so do you like it better as Mutado or Mutado?
No, Mutado, because I like the way that Shayna says it. She goes, the Great Mutado.
Yeah, I like that pronunciation of it.
The Great Mutado.
Yeah, and I think Mutado would make it some much more, less mutant, more potato.
Yeah, exactly. So, the Great Mutado.
That would be a focus on, like, well, why is he a potato?
Right, exactly.
Even though his face is a little more lumpy and potato-like.
Yeah, poor Mutado.
We get a reference here to, again, this is not a mythological episode, but Mulder does make reference here to him... Like, oh, you believe in all these alien abductions? And Mulder just points out, like, I'm not sure I believe in those anymore.
Yeah, so it's like the only indication that other things have happened outside this episode.
Which is, again, one of those things that you mentioned before that I now appreciate upon having watched previous episodes, right? That we, only a few episodes ago, we got into that entire Redux storyline where Mulder now is a bit more of a skeptic.
Yeah, and I feel like the way that Scully acts in this episode is very typical Scully, but it's also this like classic Gillian Anderson eye roll that she does, and
yeah,
I love it.
She's giving a lot of face to these, you know, freaky deaky
people.
Yeah,
it's very sassy, and I feel like you have an appreciation for that now.
Yeah, so the Great Mutado, though, they find him for a second, right? Because they go out into a field, because Izzy is, you know, someone who has drawn him in the past.
Yes.
They put out a sandwich.
Well, basically, yeah, Scully finds the comic book, and the mom is like, oh, no, that's the Great Mutado. And she's like, they are the same thing.
Yeah.
And Izzy comes home.
This is literally what you describe with two mouths and everything.
And Izzy comes home, and he's just like, oh. And she's like, well, how did you come up with this character? And he's like, well, I've seen him.
And, you know, and he says, like, everyone in town has seen him.
Yeah, so why does the mom not know that? It's very weird.
But Scully, as you said, believes all this is a hoax. So they're going to lay this quote-unquote trap for Mutado.
Because I guess they do this all the time.
But basically she tells Mulder, like, this is just a hoax that the town came up with so they could be famous, like on Jerry Springer.
Yeah, and meanwhile, and I pointed this out because you don't notice it if you're watching for the first time, but Izzy does put a tape recorder, presses play, or presses record and puts it in his pocket.
Because he's going to eventually leak this conversation to the press.
Yeah, so Scully's basically like, this is nonsense, but they put the peanut butter sandwich out and he shows up.
And he takes two bites, which is interesting
to me.
Well,
he has two mouths.
Well, yeah, but like, I didn't realize the second mouth was functional.
I think it's just for sillies.
Yeah, I thought it was more so, like, I feel like when you have things that are vestigial, I think it's just that they don't do anything.
I mean, if you see it, it's like it's a moving sort of mouth, so.
Yeah, I wish he talked out of both mouths.
Yeah,
or,
maybe
like,
he does.
Maybe he, like, can do it, he'd be the best ventriloquist ever, because he could just cover up his second mouth, and nobody would know that he's talking.
I don't know if that works like that.
But as you mentioned before, I really like the goofy music that plays throughout this.
That's sort of like...
It's very much like, what is it, like Calliope music from the circus, right?
Yeah, circus, yeah. Yeah, so I like that too, because it makes it a little like quirky.
Yeah, and a little more freaky. And speaking of freaky, as everyone chases after the great Mutato, high on a hill is a lonely goat herd in the form of this like crotchety old man.
Yeah, and he's like holding like a shovel or a gun. I forget what it is, but
get off of my property.
Yeah, he basically says there are no monsters.
And now,
I've told you kids this before, that there's no monster. And
now,
he's not lying. He doesn't think of him as a monster.
Exactly. And he's very protective. But
and he says you should go see Dr. Polidori.
Polidori Pomelini?
Polidori.
Polidori. Okay.
Francis Polidori.
Polenta. Played by John O'Hurley.
Which is, he does such a good job here.
He's so freaking good. So I had read that John O'Hurley actually had auditioned a number of times for The X-Files in the past.
Oh,
but
really?
Chris Carter was like, this is not, like, this show isn't really for him, but this is perfect, right?
Yeah.
This is, like,
soapy,
over the top, you know, like,
the way he talks is just so weird.
Well, he's very, I mean, that's the way reason why, like, he impressed so much as Jay Peterman on Seinfeld.
Yeah.
He has this very distinct and heightened way of talking.
Yes.
Where everything sounds incredibly dramatic and important.
Yeah, and so he's going through this, like, I guess, speech about his, he's a geneticist, and he's doing a genetic experiment. Yeah,
he's basically like a mad scientist, in that he is studying genetics, but also putting it into practice, where he's like, oh, I realized that the fruit flies sort of have almost like genetic sections to them.
And
so I thought if I did experiments on the specific sections, I could crossbreed to make things whatever I wanted.
Yeah. And so this is something that Chris Carter is, it's actually real. The fruit fly with legs in its mouth.
Really?
So
that picture was real?
He has a scientific advisor for the show.
Could have fooled me.
He does. He has a scientific advisor for the show. And I guess a friend of the scientific advisor was a geneticist who did this.
Oh, really?
Yes.
That's wild.
Yeah, so it's like a real thing if you like read about it a little bit. But
you talked about the Mulder and Scully sort of like straight man aspect of this episode. I do love the exchange that they give to each other as Polenta goes in, as you said, like goes into this monologue like, oh, it's absolutely beautiful, this fruit fly.
Yeah.
So this is what I did.
Yeah, they're like, what?
So a little bit of Jurassic Park stuff here with, you know, why did you do it? Because I can.
Yeah, he's like a modern day Frankenstein, Victor Frankenstein.
Exactly, and Frankenstein, please.
Sorry.
Yeah, and so, of course, we fall into our natural character beats, right? Where after this conversation, Mulder's like, I am fascinated with this at Dan Scully's. Like, you're just drawn in by his sultry voice. This is all a crock.
Yeah, but I mean, which is weird because I do think Scully should be a little bit more fascinated with genetics, considering she's like a medical doctor, but also like had done a bunch of genetic experiments.
I just think she is now, I think she thinks at this point she's being punked.
Yeah,
that,
which,
like, this whole town is trying to trick
and they're
her.
All acting so strange. Like, it's rural Indiana, so it's like a very weird vibe to begin with.
I mean, to that point, again, if we're cutting to the soapiness, we follow Dr. Pomodoro home.
Polidori.
Where he's in this, like, very dramatized, strained relationship with his wife. Right?
Yeah,
like,
so
where are you going? I've told you, I'm leaving.
Yeah.
But
I have work to do.
But can't we have children? No, I told you that we can't. These mewling little monsters.
Yeah, he's one of those guys that's like all about his work. So he doesn't want to have kids because that's going to like take away from his work, I guess.
Well, and also, I think
why is he even married?
The irony, though, is that like he's doing all this genetic manipulation, yet he hates offspring, right?
Yeah, and he like, I don't even know why this woman married him. Like, he seems like the worst.
He seems like an absolutely terrible.
She probably
person.
Married him because he was like a doctor and one of those things, you know. And
oh, a doctor. Okay, I won't dive further into what that means.
Yeah, so
just show me that doctorate, baby.
Yeah, exactly. And then she realizes he's like not all that. But anyway,
we should also talk about the aesthetic of the house, right? Because we see it more.
Oh Lord, it is just so garish.
Is a choice.
Yeah, so the whole house is covered in this, like, really garish wallpaper.
Even from a black and white perspective, you can tell. It's probably, like, a juice green or something.
And it, like, looks like it's decorated for Christmas time. There's, like, garlands everywhere
garlands
with
and
lights.
Yeah, so you could tell maybe it's just this lady sort of trying to plant this idea of, like, oh, it's Christmas every day.
I doubt it's, like, Christmassy. It's probably, like, more like a fairyland vibe. Because it's, like, they're not really, like, Christmas garlands. They're, like, flowers. So it's, like, very, like, a like twinkle lights and, you know, floofy.
Yeah. So as she sort of
probably has 100 pillows on the bed.
Speaking of the bed, like after he leaves, she like throws herself on the bed.
Yeah, she's
right?
crying. Like,
there's no fainting couch. You're like, oh my God, my miserable existence. And down come the fumigation tents.
Yes. And so the same thing happens to her. She's knocked unconscious and attacked.
Yeah. But You're speaking about how freaky deaky the town is. We see it here as Mulder
goes
into the diner.
At JJ's with two J's.
With two J's. I guess, I wonder if Parks and Rec, obviously there was JJ's diner there. I wonder if that's a reference to it.
I don't think so, but it's
but we
still-
see everyone gawking at him, for lack of a better term, right? Like, they're all smiling and staring at him because they're basically, because he's famous, right? There was an article in the paper that was like, oh, FBI agents, come to town. And so everyone assumes this means we're going to be on TV.
Exactly. So they're all giving him whatever he wants, which is nothing. He just wants coffee. But they give him like this full diner breakfast. And they're like, are you going to get us on Jerry Springer? And like asking him all these questions.
Yeah, because Izzy leaked their tape conversation.
Yes.
And they focus less so, I think, on the Scully part and more so on the Mulder part.
Yeah,
thing,
which
right?
is like,
this is what they're thinking.
Yeah, exactly. And so they're everybody's favorite right now.
So it should also be noted, though, so they go back, confront Izzy about it. Izzy's going to play the conversation on the tape recorder, which also picks up something else, which I'm intrigued by.
The Cher music.
Yeah, Mutato singing to Cher.
Yeah.
When did he record that?
So I think what happened was when Izzy left, maybe he left the tape recorder on. And then it recorded it while it was happening. I don't think, like...
So, like, he partially taped over it
because
he was recording Mulder and Scully, and he just happened to, like, catch a snippet of Mutato singing
exactly.
along.
There's probably, like, a whole, like, tape that's missing of Mutato singing along.
I gotta say, Mutato's a pretty good karaoke performer, right? Like, he was selling it to no one in particular, because now we cut...
Yeah, I guess this is when he's really letting go, when he gets into these houses.
We cut back to, that night, right, when he's in the same house as the doctor's wife, and he's just, like...
Dancing.
He's... In his feeling his oats.
I love
right
him
now.
Dancing, and it's just,
with
I think...
With or without you.
Yeah, so I do really love that. And I think that's when you get the vibe that, like, he's not a rapist. Like, you're like, there's clearly something else going on
either
here.
Either that or this is some sort of, like, Clockwork Orange freaky-deaky bullshit where someone's taking delight
that
in
vibe.
Very dark things.
You can't feel that when you hear Cher.
Yeah, but also I know that, again, like, let's look at Home.
Mm-hmm.
The X-Files are certainly capable of doing
yes,
dark things.
Yes, but they don't use Cher as the backing music.
Yeah, but they do use some plaintive 50s
music. I just think there's something about Cher that's like very just so happy you can't like, you just can't use it that way.
This is when Mulder invokes the title, right? He's going to talk about the postmodern Prometheus, which I guess again is a reference to like this situation is happening, but in a very different 90s-like fashion.
Yeah, so it's a modern day Frankenstein situation. But they find on the stove, just as Shayna said, something had been burnt.
Burning.
And so they're going to get it tested because they actually have the residue this time. She didn't clean the thing like Shayna did stupidly.
And so as they're driving along with Gypsies, Tramps, and Thieves playing.
Oh, so good.
Such a great song.
So they pull up to the house.
Yeah, so they're driving along, right? And Mulder has a brain blast. He's like, what would be something that would allow someone to like get gassed out, but for no one to notice it at all, and he sees the fumigation.
Yeah,
tank. And so
and
he's
then
like,
he's
"Let's
like,
pull, let's look into it."
Yeah, and then Gypsies, Tramps, and Thieves starts playing. It's so amazing.
Yeah, I would say that was the best song of the episode. But of course, we got to talk about the one later on.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
So yeah, Mulder and Scully, they're charging in, but I think maybe they acted before they thought because they very quickly collapse from the gas.
Yeah, they forget that it's gas. So
yeah, like even if the fumigation tent, like even if it was just a regular fumigation thing, you're still wandering in without a gas mask on or something to cover your mouth.
Yeah, and basically at the end of this investigation, Polidori's like, "Why are you in my house? You should be going to see my father," but he doesn't.
Right, first of all, they're met by the old man wearing a gas mask, who says briefly, like, you know, I told you, ain't no monster.
Well, I don't think they remember that, though.
No, but we see him.
Yes.
And then when they wake up, you have just that general, what are you doing in my house?
Yeah.
And also, he does such a great job, John O'Hurley in general, of just delivering the, oh my God.
Yeah, but the residue that was on the thing basically leads them to the father. But before that, he goes to visit his dad, right?
Yeah, but first there's a fun scene that you like.
Oh, yes.
you lolled at where they're confronting Molly and Skull Moldy. No, that's been a while since I've done the whole Moldy thing. But they're talking with them about like what exactly happened here.
And he like stands up too quickly.
He stands up too quickly and knocks over a shelf, which is great physical comedy. But also there's this one moment where Mulder says like, your wife may be pregnant, and you see the
wife just like pops up.
Like, My dreams.
Yeah, she like
true.
Smiles super big. This actress is like really funny.
She's so cheesy, but I love it. It's
she's again, like,
it's so soapy, but like I'm just into
it's
this
hilarious.
Aesthetic so much.
Yeah, she's like stoked that she might have been raped.
So this is where we get the reveal that Mutato is at least being taken care of by the old farmer.
Yeah, the dad comes downstairs and this is where he's watching. He eats the sandwich, right?
Yeah, while he's watching Mask, he's like, "Well, don't stay up too late watching your movie."
Don't stay up too late, son.
He's ruminating on this photo album of all these pictures with him.
So he's clearly had him since he was little.
Yeah. But here comes, John O'Hurley coming in, and we get another exchange of like, why? Because I can.
Yeah. And he's like, but basically, John O'Hurley's like, why? Like, you shouldn't have done that. Like, insinuating that he meant to kill this thing that he created.
And so he kills him.
Yeah. So he kills his own dad, which
he
is pretty rough.
He kills his own dad, which, you know, Spencer makes some points about how, like, this old farmer was doing some pretty shady stuff, but he didn't kill anyone like his son
did. He didn't kill anyone, and he also seemed to be a very nice man taking care of somebody who probably wouldn't have had anyone.
Yeah, and that's all he was doing, was just trying to create like a Bride of Frankenstein in a manner of speaking.
Exactly, yeah. Which, again, not great, but also not as bad as murdering your own dad.
What a difference a day makes here. It seems like another story has now come out that is now picking up on the Scully side of things, where now the headline is like, FBI claims it's a big old hoax, and now Mulder is getting the cold shoulder, he's getting his food, like, outwardly spit in, coffee is getting poured on him, so clearly this shows, again, very, very timely today, even, of how, like, one minute you're on top, and the next minute you are the person who gets like lambasted on the internet.
Exactly. So very much so mob mentality, and I like that they have like actual pitchforks and torches. It's,
yeah,
like,
we'll see. That. It's very much Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah,
right?
Later like, on. Yeah.
Raise your guns, raise your knives. We find out for a hot second here that, you know, we get a brief second where Izzy. You know, the town gets riled up because...
Yes, Izzy has ordered a custom mask of the Great Mutato because he designed the character. It's
exactly.
Probably just for his comic book.
But everyone's like, oh, look what this guy's doing. There's a really fun shot where it cuts back to Izzy and he's behind the glass of the post office putting his mouth up to
him.
This is, again, a reminder of, like, these are very simple people.
Simple people is the best way to describe it.
So they find their way back to the farm because the test results reveal... that the urinal cake was an anesthetic that's
for farm animals.
Typically used on farm animals.
And you have to register with the FDA to get it.
And also, like, there's only one farmer in this town, basically.
Yes, and so he has it, and they go there, and they basically discover that he has been murdered.
Well, no, because we see Mutato find him first, right? And Mutato
He buries him.
Goes to bury him in the barn, and so they're going to find their way to the barn.
But and then the bird lady tells them.
So, yeah, so this is a bird lady, quite literally. They find there's this, like, bookish, bird-like newspaper reporter in the alcove, right?
So did at any point you realize that she was a bird?
So I noticed that...
She was the one that was doing the most work.
Yeah, because I noticed specifically in this conversation, because we've seen her a couple times, right? Like,
from an acting perspective,
she's been a bird. But the way she was looking around, I was even more than a bird, I said, oh, she kind of is looking around like a chicken.
Yeah, very like bobbing her head.
She was doing a lot of work with her neck.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was a little over the top because the rest of the characters who are animalistic are not doing that.
No, because they're more so the looks, right? Like, Booger has the long
hair. Well, she has the look, too. She has, like, a really pointed nose that's clearly prosthetic, and she has, big eyes, and she has this, like, weird hair.
Yeah, and it also doesn't
she's wearing feathers.
Of those characters that I mentioned, she's really the only one who talks.
Yes, true.
So she also has to represent it through the way that she speaks.
Well, Izzy talks, and he's a pig.
Yeah, but... Oh, I guess that's true. Yeah. So, you know, as she's talking about this, here comes Gaston.
Uh-huh.
John O'Hurley could have played a good Gaston when he was younger.
True.
So basically, the villagers are going to, like, ransack the barn, right? Because they believe that Mutato murdered the old man, and so they're going to get revenge.
Yep. But they
accidentally burn it down.
They burn the farm down. Yeah. So this was like wild to me. This is supposedly taking place in modern day. They do have flashlights and lanterns, but in addition, they have fire torches that they bring into a wooden barn.
Yeah.
Wild assumption.
Simple-minded people. They're cross-bred.
You keep saying
animals.
That, but this is dumb.
maybe this is a step away from it. Yeah. They're like, wait a minute. Fire on wood?
Well,
never
then the one
this.
Guy screams, the barn's on fire.
So there's chaos going on around them. But then we finally get, like, Well, first we get John O'Hurley's side of things, right? Of like, yeah. Oh, you must have killed him. My father created this mutant, which is
a lie. Yeah, they basically, he says it's my father and that he must have killed him, not John O'Hurley, which is like very much so not the case.
Exactly. But Mutato finally talks. He's not just singing Cher. Well, he can speak as well.
Scully and Mulder find him first in his like little house and they
on the prairie
and they basically discover his little Cher shrine. And remember say
hashtag Cher shrine.
Cher shrine. And then they basically do speak with him. You know, eventually he comes out and says like that 25 years ago, like he was created as a genetics experiment by him, Dr. Polidori, and that, you know, that unbeknownst to the doctor, the father took him in and saved him.
Right, because essentially he was like, this was a failed experiment.
Yeah, he was going to throw him away.
Yeah, by that I mean kill him.
Yeah.
And so basically he reveals that, okay, my quote-unquote father, technically grandfather, but adopted father, worked on creating a mate for me. So that's why these townspeople resemble animals.
Because he's been trying to create hybrids from farm animals for 25 years. Which is wild.
So are we to believe then that the parents of these people are farm animals?
No. So I think what he's doing is taking like human DNA and farm animal DNA and then using that to insert, like basically probably taking human sperm, splicing it with farm animal DNA and then artificially inseminating women.
But like, for example, is Izzy's father a pig?
Maybe, but maybe a pig and a human.
Yeah, that's weird. That's a little
like, I don't think that would work. I think it would be like, you'd have to take like pig DNA and then splice it with like human sperm. And, you know, I don't know much about genetics, but I know more than they probably.
We need a Chris Carter science correspondent here.
But anyway, I mean, I don't think you're supposed to look too much into it. And other than he was trying to recreate the experiment that his son did to give the great Mutato a mate, but the son is basically like, I can't recreate you. You were a mistake.
Exactly. And so he's just like, all I was doing was just hanging out at your houses. I didn't do anything.
Yeah. So the townspeople realize he's not a monster after all, but Dr. Polidori is, because he's arrested for the murder of his father.
He does still have like a smile on his way out though. So like, he's not, I don't think he's even remorseful.
No, he's just like,
he's also like,
he's a little full of himself.
And he's also just like fixed in the head.
Yeah.
You know, he's like, I'm brilliant.
Yeah. And he thinks that he did right, you know?
Yeah. So now Scully and Mulder are standing around. And this is, again, where I think the ending debate comes in, right? Because Mulder's like, this is not how the story ends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in Frankenstein, the monster goes off to
find a bride.
I need to talk to the writer.
Yeah.
And so then we cut to this like convoy of cars driving out of town.
I don't think this is fake, though. I think he was just saying, I got to talk to the writer, like saying it's silly so that he could figure out with Izzy how to get this guy to a Cher concert. Like, I think he just used Izzy as a helper.
Even if it's fake, I'm fine with it. You know, like I'm happy. I love this ending because you know what? The X-Files is a great show. It's a spooky show. It's a weird show. I want some freaking happiness, people, okay?
Yeah, exactly.
I think we deserve it. And
yeah.
I think, fake or not, we get it here as we hear Cher's incredible cover of Walking in Memphis playing, which, like,
makes one of my favorites.
Makes you smile from ear to ear to third ear.
Walking in Memphis.
Yeah, and so we start with just, like, them sitting in the car, right? And, like, Mutato's in the back seat and, like, exchanging smiling glances with Mulder and Scully. And then we see this like small venue where Cher's performing, and it does this really fun thing, which seems so different than anything the X-Files has done, where it just like zooms into the audience and their Mutato is fist pumping. Arms to the chorus.
Well, because
of
they're doing a long shot from the back and overhead of the performer, so it's very like hard for them to zoom in quickly, and so it looks really cool though.
Yeah,
the way
it's done. It's ridiculous, but it like has me smiling so much because there's so much joy. It's so goofy yet heartwarming at the same time.
Anyway.
So like he's high-fiving Mulder.
I've done some research for you. The person impersonating Cher, her name is Tracy Bell, and she is a Canadian comedian, impersonator, and impressionist.
Oh.
And she is known for her live impersonations of celebrities like Cher, Marilyn Monroe, Madonna, Liza Minnelli, Tina Turner, Janis Joplin, which is weird because she's white, How could she be Tina Turner? And Dolly Parton. So, yeah, there you go.
But she didn't sing the song. Like, she's an impressionist of Cher, but
yes, she didn't sing that song. I mean, that's just an overtrack.
She just has the look down.
Yeah, exactly.
We should also mention here,
I'm sure she sings in shows, you know? Yeah,
we should also mention here at the end, I know that Brendan Fitzpatrick referenced this, and I looked it up as well, that the person who plays the Grey Mutato is not a newcomer to the X-Files.
No, he is not. He plays the young cigarette-smoking man, and his name is Something Owens.
Something Owens. That is wild to me.
Chris Owens.
That they say, well, I guess, you know, they know that he's good, right? Because we saw the young cigarette-smoking man most prominently in Musings of a Cigarette-Smoking Man. He popped up again in Demons. So, like, I guess they had him on the Rolodex, but it's wild to me that they're like, yeah, just use him.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, he's really good at it. He does a great job.
Yeah, but you can't recognize him at all.
And is that his voice, too, do you think?
I would imagine so.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I would imagine when you put on the prosthetic, you might not even need to put on a voice.
Yeah, you just, like, talk through the muffled.
Oh, this is so much fun. Like,
this is my favorite part of the episode,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, and then we also cut to, you know, around the town. For example, we have Shayna and the doctor's wife are now on Jerry Springer with their mutant babies, but they love their mutant babies.
They love their mutant babies. And yeah, they're all dancing and they're all being so happy. And, then we see Scully and Mulder dance.
Yeah. So basically Cher takes the Grey Mutato up to, I guess, dance on stage.
Yeah. Dance on stage. I mean, they probably told her, like, it was probably like a, you're a fan, come on stage thing.
Yeah. Make a wish type of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
But yeah, Mulder is going to offer his hand and Scully's going to take it and they're going to dance.
But in the best, like, most non-romantic, romantic way.
That's the thing that I know I mentioned before, particularly in that scene outside the hospital room in season 4. I was like, I'm not feeling this.
Now you feel it.
I felt it a little bit. I felt it a smidge.
I always feel it at this moment, and it makes my, like, heart sore. I'm just so happy.
Yeah, which again, like,
because it's the perfect encapsulation of their relationship, where it's like they care about each other so much and they're so happy in this moment, and it's not about something sad.
And that's the thing as well. I realize when we cut to again that really fun shot of them in the audience, I don't think we've ever really had a time in the X-Files where both Mulder and Scully
they're
are
like
smiling,
grinning, ear to ear. Because I'm sure they were having fun filming this,
And also genuinely grinning, right? It's not like a, oh my god, can you believe this? Like,
yeah,
they were
no,
both genuinely
fun.
Enjoying themselves.
Yeah, so I think, I mean, this is my favorite episode, and I hope it also is yours now.
I mean, I really enjoyed it. It's tough to say. I think I'm probably will be unable to identify my favorite episode after all this, but
that's
I think it's
true.
Definitely up there because, again, I think it's more freaky than scary. I think it's a nice break from the alien stuff, though still makes reference to it. I think Mulder and Scully are being Mulder and Scully.
Mm-hmm.
It's a weird-ass mystery, and it has, real or not, a really, like, lifting ending. And I know that some people might say that's not X-Files, but, like, I don't care, to be completely honest. I like light, heartwarming things. This was a light, heartwarming ending.
Yeah, I mean, there's an element of bittersweetness to it, and that, like, he's, like, different and not accepted and all of that. But I think the fact that it, like, ends in this way is just,
Let's talk Spook of the Week for a second. Unusual Suspects. Is it Sudan Modesky?
Yeah, I guess she's pretty spooky. It's either her or it's X at the end.
I'm going to say Suzanne Modesky because she, like, comes in, right? Like, she's full in on the conspiracy stuff. She really makes an impression.
Totally.
And then Postmodern Prometheus, we got a lot of choices
here. I think John Hurley.
You think Dr.
Yeah. He's not the great. Yeah, he's not the greatest.
He's not the greatest. He's also, like, I think he also brings that dread, right, in the way that he delivers things. Like, it was a dark and stormy night.
Yeah, I think he's my Spook of the Week.
So where do we go from here? How do you follow up those two episodes? The answer is, you just go to the next two episodes.
Yeah, so the next two episodes are like the opposite direction.
Okay, how so?
In a mood.
Okay, well, I'm glad we got a little bit of light.
They ain't funny.
All right, well, we got our giggles out here. So we're going to be covering quite literally the next two episodes in season 5. We're doing episode 6, Christmas Carol, and episode 7, Emily. Christmas Carol is interesting. Do we know, did it air during Christmas?
Yeah, it's a Christmas-themed episode, too.
I guess if it started in the fall, I guess it would go
tangential to Christmas, I should say. It's not Christmas-themed.
All right, well, that should be fun. We've never had, like, an X-Files holiday special before.
Yeah, it's not a holiday special again, but it's...
Ooh, I wonder if there'll be, like, aliens of Christmas
past. Will say that I do think Bill Scully appears in this episode.
Oh, old Bill Scully Jr. So we shall see. So again, next week, episode 6, Christmas Carol, episode 7. Emily, you know what to do if you have thoughts. X-Files at postshowrecaps.com, Bloomfiles at postshowrecaps.com. Going through all this stuff you already know at this point, at Ange Pelagi, at A Mike Bloom Type, at postshowrecaps on Twitter. If you want to let us know your thoughts about these two big episodes and the episodes coming up as well. Season 5 is already off to a very fun start. Again, I enjoyed season 4, but I'm happy to have a bit of lightness here, at least to start. Seems like we're going back in the season 4 direction next week.
Yeah, sorry.
No, it's okay.
I really like these episodes, though. I think they're well done.
It was a good week, you know? I feel like it is the equivalent of listening to a Cher song. I feel invigorated. I feel empowered.
Great.
Speaking of music, special thanks to Corey B. for the excellent theme song to The Bloom Files, which you're listening to right now. We're going to be back next week with Christmas Carol and Emily. Thank you all so much for listening. Until next week, case closed.